Went up to the stupa this morning to take a look at the work that Silva Ra and his group have been doing on this restoration of this remarkable spiritual center that in many ways was constructed for Rudy, but really represents the lineage of Rudy in the world. And it is a center that was built many years ago, 5 years ago or so?
81.
81, wow, goes way back. And has fallen into disrepair. And one of the things that's been happening to me over the course of the last few years, as you know, I've become kind of a photographer, and what I'm finding myself drawn to is disrepair, the breaking down of that which has been built, finding a surprising beauty in decay, in rust, in mold, in patterns that exist in the world when things start to fail to cohere. And what has been so surprising to me is how much beauty exists in that. And what hit me when I went up to the stupa is that it's this extraordinary space of holding energy, if you will, building energy, celebrating, if you want to put it that way, the energy that Rudy represented and his lineage represents in this world to this minute. And so it is under construction and becoming increasingly beautiful while it's falling apart. It is kind of the essence of non-duality. It is the creative and the uncreative, the creation of and the destruction of something almost simultaneously. And in a sense, we all represent that. Every one of us is in the process of being created at the same time that our bodies are already starting to decay. And it's a process that is at the core of the breath of existence. It breathes in and it breathes out. It inhales, it exhales. We are born, we die. Everything follows that pattern. And we tend to have, as people, an enormous celebration of the birth and the creation and the construction of the universe we live in. And we tend to look the other way when it starts to fall apart. When the infrastructure is no longer working, people don't want to pay attention to that. Why fix what's broken? Why not just build new stuff? But in fact, to sustain itself, the world needs to be in a state of constant repair, constant effort, constant maintenance, to the point at which that no longer works. And every one of us is going to find ourselves in a space at some point where there's nothing left to fix you. Those of you who've held cars for long periods of time, Blanche and I often have had cars for 15, 20 years. My car right now, it's a car from 1989. And it still doesn't have 100,000 miles on it, but it is definitely falling into some, not real disrepair because I've been good with it, but it can't go on forever. And these other cars we've had, really, they get to a point and they say, we don't have replacement parts. And you have to kind of accept that at a certain point in time, it's going to be completely demolished. And I'm talking about not just cars, but us. We are this simultaneous evolution and de-evolution of existence. We focus on the thing that's happening in the moment. We arise every day and we go, ah, I'm here, I've got work to do, I've got to get to the job, I've got to do this, I've got to do that, keeping busy, constructing, building this life, and then slowly watching this thing you built kind of reach a point where it is done. You've built it. You've had a career. You had a job. They throw you a retirement party. They give you a gold watch. Whatever it is that happens, suddenly that effort, all that time, all that drive comes to an end, and there you are, Who am I? What am I? The cycle is starting to go downward into dissolution. And we are in a very interesting culture that pays very little attention to that ride. We pay our attention to the building, to the constructing, to the celebration of that which was built. When half of the journey goes in the other direction and we barely look at it, we are dismissive of it. And that's a source of great suffering for people because they don't acknowledge, they don't accept, they don't believe that they are going to face annihilation. And I don't mean that to be scary. I don't mean it to be a negative, and I think there are probably people listening to this talk now who just push delete. And I get it. I get it. Who wants to hear that stuff? Who wants to hear that the downward slope is such a major part of one's life, and we have so little instruction, so little preparation for that journey? Basically, it's house people somewhere and pretend they don't exist, and then put them in the ground, or put them on fire, or whatever you do to people. But that journey downward is beautiful. It's filled with beauty. If you've ever looked deeply into the eyes of someone who's lived long, you see this exquisite universe of having been. You know, one of my favorite people in the world is John Mann, and you all know John. He was one of Rudy's early students, and we're sitting in an ashram that he sustains, really. And I was hugging him last night, and you know, John is 89 years old and becoming more fragile. And as I hugged him, I felt, because I knew him when he was young and vital, like I was young and vital, and I felt how that hug has turned into something different. It's like good wine. It's rich. It's got flavor. It's got quality. It has depth. It has a life lived. And for so many people, if they walked down the street and walked by John, they would see an old guy or an aging guy. And they would go, eh, old man, and just be dismissive, as are most of us, of people who have passed their prime. But in truth, if you stop for 1 minute and looked at any of these people, even the most derelict of us as we start to decay, carries with us a journey, carries with us a life experience, a richness of being that cannot and should not be denied. You don't need to go into everybody's story. I mean, sometimes that's really interesting to hear the story of their life and the journey and to kind of put it together as a series of either episodes that don't end up particularly well, or as a series of incredible triumphs and dramas and emotions and connections and disappearances and griefs and all these things that go on in people's lives, and to really get the full measure of somebody's existence and to realize every person you're looking at is an embodiment of a massive universal journey, an incredible journey. And that journey has epic proportion. That journey is to be celebrated. And that journey is to be observed with all of the exquisite ornamentation and all of the exquisite destruction that goes along with it. When I was at the shrine up at the stupa, I just started taking pictures of the parts that were not working, the parts that were falling apart. And I know Silva Ra and his group are going to put that all back together, and the next time I come, it will look beautiful and repaired. But it's such a signal right at this moment of what this is all about. This whole human experience brings us into being and takes us out of being. And it's a whole ride. It's not just come into being, die, fall apart, become insignificant in the world. There is no insignificant in the world. We are significant every second. And the universe knows that. What doesn't know that often is other people and often our own selves. We are so unprepared for the fullness of this human journey, of this human ride. And it's important to pay attention. And it's not easy. It's so interesting. I've gone to dinner with people my age. One thing we do not talk about is the future. At all. It's just not a given because Nobody wants to think of old age homes. Nobody wants to think of doctors every other day. Nobody wants to think of giving up everything you have. Who do you give all your stuff to? You know, I mean, what didn't happen in your life? What kind of should have happened? And the sadness, the happiness, the grief, I'm going to lose this, I love that. All of that stuff is in every human being, everybody. And the trick is to find a space inside of enormous stillness that reaches out and says yes to the total package. Every birth has within it the death, and every death has within it the totality of the life lived. That's as much as we sort of know. Deep within us, within the entry points of our own doorway to self, there is this observer, this witness that watches the whole thing, and that really knows and understands the whole ride that you're going through. It is a timeless space. It knows beginnings and it knows endings. It knows the infinite and it knows the finite. It is an extraordinarily aware and in some ways loving and compassionate space. If you are only in the outer journey, if your whole life is addressed to the outer journey, it will have cause for amazement, celebration, misery, unhappiness, depression, death. All of it. And it will all be perceived as it's occurring, and it will all be perceived with this experience of wanting, holding, embracing, losing, suffering. And the suffering comes from the simple fact that ultimately it's all lost. So no matter how beautiful it is, how wonderful it is, how complete it is at some moment in time, it's temporary. It's going to go poof, either quickly or gradually. To live your life completely in the outer, which is what most people do, is ultimately giving yourself over to great loss, grief, and unhappiness. How do you get away from that? How do you find a place that doesn't give itself over to that? Well, the real key is, forgive me for coming to a point that I come to every time I talk, the inward door to the witness that knows it all, that has seen it all, that is it all. And this door goes inside into a world that is in many ways the equal to and maybe even greater than this outer journey. I say it might be greater than because once you enter that world, the timelessness of it seems to be something that has no beginning and no end. People call it infinite and eternal. Its vastness is scary to the ego mind, but a total repose to the witness itself. It just knows itself. It knows us better than we do. And it takes us in, and it reaches out and makes a wholeness of the outer and the inner universe. By going inside, you become complete. You become what you are and who you are. It doesn't mean you don't live a life outside. If anything, you live the outside life with a kind of clarity and perhaps even wisdom or maturity beyond your years. And you do see lots of people like that who somehow know things. They somehow are clear about it. They have a sense of what the world is. Some of them practice meditation, some of them don't practice. Some of them just are born awake or connected or lucky, whatever you want to call it. Some people just are there. But most people that I have met in my life don't even have a clue that there's a doorway in. They don't even know there's a place to go. They don't even know there's, the word salvation popped into my head, that there is salvation. It's not exactly salvation, but it's something that allows you to be you authentically, completely, joyfully, without feeling that the you that you need to become has to appease or make anybody else happy. The you that needs to become is happening all by itself. And all you have to do is bring all of your wisdom and consciousness and attention and energy to the building of your life and to the dismantling of your life. That's your job. And this will help guide you through it and carry you to the point where you give yourself over completely again to the space from which you arose. You go back to yourself. You go back to this incredible state of being. Most of us are very obsessed by doing, and being is completely taken for granted. Of course we're being. I'm a human being. What do you think? I'm a being, and I be. But the truth is, most of us are not good at being. Most of us really find it kind of scary to even contemplate being, because it's such an abstraction for us. It doesn't have weight, it doesn't have a space, it doesn't have a locus. It seems to be kind of everywhere. The mind can't grasp it. It's not knowable in some traditional sort of intellectual sense, even emotional sense. It's just kind of there. You know, the two fish swimming in water and saying, what's this thing called water? I've never seen it. Of course, you're in it. You don't see it, you're it. But here we are with this universe of being that we do not know. We do not grasp, we do not touch, except for the fact that it's always there. This entry point, the heart, the gut, your ego-mindedness, your third eye intellect, all of these entry points go inside into the you that you are potentially able to discover if you want to go there. And you see people do it without knowing it. I talk a lot about, you know, the navel chakra, which is, you know, this chakra of physical grace in a way, the ability to achieve and do in the world. And I always watch, you know, when I watch the basketball games, and you see the perfect three-pointer, and you just feel it coming from the navel chakra, and this grace of making something happen in the world that is so beautiful, that ball arriving, going across the whole court and somehow finding its way to that basket, and something in you goes, oh, that's what it feels like in there. When somebody speaks and they have an eloquence of speech where the words match the thought, match the feeling, express the truth, the poetry of being, when that happens, something in you goes, oh. When you look at somebody who's truly beautiful, or you look at a painting that's truly beautiful, that just touches you so deeply, you go, when you understand something, when something clarifies for you for the first time, and you go, oh, oh, that's what that means. These are the aesthetic moments in the world that we live in, that touch upon the inner space. I don't know that Steph Curry knows how he does what he does. I don't know that Einstein knew what he was doing. You know, Hemingway, did he know that was coming out of his throat chakra? I have no idea. But people who find themselves discomforted in the world for one reason or another, or who have somehow awakened to the possibility that there's more to life than what's outside us, people who have begun to think there's something else, something more, something other, something bigger, something better, begin the journey that you are all on into yourself. And the access point tends to come from sitting still and discovering this series of openings that can take place. Some of you go in deeply through your heart, some go through your mind, some go through your gut, some of you really begin to open all these centers and find enormous contentment and awareness in the bigness of your being. It's hard to go there inside for a lot of reasons. One is we're born to get interested and involved in the world. We are obsessed in what's outside. The outside seems to be everything. We are connected to others. We want to be connected to others. We love the thing around us. And so it completely removes us from this inner journey. It's only some kind of suffering or some kind of accident of birth or something that happens when you're young. For me, it was, I saw that people died. And I went, whoa, well, that changes everything. If they die, what does that mean? I immediately got totally caught in that as a little kid. You know, it was kind of shocking. I was with my dad and my mother in a car, and we saw a crowd of people, and we stopped the car, and we got out, and my father took me, my mother waited in the car, and we walked over to this place, and there was a girl my age lying on the ground covered with a blanket that was completely soaked in blood, and she was dying. She had been hit by a car. And I went, and I never stopped going. It was the beginning. It was a total gift on some horrible level, because it made me go, this is dangerous. This world is not the answer. This world can go like that, and we all know it. But that was my awakening to that reality. And it went on and on from there, but I knew that I had to find stuff inside. I had no idea how. You know, the closest I came was this idea of prayer, praying to something unseen and unknown, but that was always like an outer thing, like thy Father who art in heaven, you know. Out there, no. The LSD experience in the 60s was like, poof, inward. It just absolved the world. It took the world and dissolved it in a split second. My whole life just meant nothing in a second. And then there was just this unbelievable unending bigness. And it was, I wouldn't want to talk about the whole experience because I could take the rest of this talk, but it brought me to a place of saying, I don't know anything. This is huge. This little life I had was nothing compared to the bigness of what really is. And then when I returned from that, which was an unexpected event, and was told, tell people what you saw, which is what I'm doing as I speak to you right now, when I was told to do that, I started to go, well, what was it? What was it? And what I realized was there was something called meditation, that Eastern philosophy had doorways into this massive universe for a long time, and our Western culture hadn't. It just didn't talk about it. It talked about when you die, when you finally go to heaven. And that didn't, this was like, this happened in the middle of a life, not at the end of a life. So here I am, going onto this trip inward. And here's what I learned in sitting over the course of 50 years. One, I didn't want to do it. Two, it's boring at first. One is easily distracted. There are many other things one could do that are much more important and meaningful or effective than sitting still. That it's a total waste of time. And get me out of here. That's the experience of sitting for most people. Why am I doing this? I could be at, you know, I could be out having a drink. I could be out watching, you know, Seinfeld reruns. I mean, there's so many things you could be doing. Why would one want to sit? And so when you sit and you meditate, there is this unbelievable resistance to sitting and meditating. Everything in you goes, this, why? Until one day, if you're determined enough and muscular enough internally and willful enough and determined enough, this thing goes, whoop, just like this, whoop. No, not a big deal, it's a tiny little whoop. You go, whoa. Whoa, it's so sweet. It feels so good. It's like eating chocolate for the first time or having an ice cream cone or making love or whatever. It's like, you go, okay, I'll do that again. And then you sit down again, it's not there. And then you give up. You go, that was a once in a lifetime experience. You know, I had an awakening. I had a whoop. And you kind of walk away from it, and you maybe start teaching classes and writing books. But the reality is, if you keep sitting in this space, the whoop gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And the draw in becomes something that is not unlike the draw outward. You start to feel a kind of balance, a kind of harmony, a kind of inner space that begins to be as big as the outer space. Even bigger, because it doesn't stop at the borders of your body or the borders of your mind. It just keeps going. Your mind can't even follow it. Your mind doesn't know what to do, and finally, if you're lucky, gives up. And in giving up, it goes, bigger and you cannot encapsulate it. It's just this bigness of being. This bigness of being becomes as rich as, perhaps richer than, the outer world. Here's the danger. I know people who have found the doorway in and go, I don't want to go out again. I don't want to be in life again. That's too hard. This is easy. This is the sweetest thing ever. And it is. And it's full of awareness. It's full of magic. It's full of spiritual witnessing of so much comes at you from going inside. And the deeper you go, the bigger it gets. But the thing Rudy taught us is that this spiritual inner space is completely reflected in the outer space. And to have one and not the other is to become completely imbalanced. I remember hearing the word, you can't have tick without tock. You can't have inhalation without exhalation. There's this thing that goes on that's in and out, tick and tock. It's this thing of yin and yang. It's infinitely necessary. So if you are totally lost in the world, you're going to have a very hard time. If you're totally lost in the inner landscape of your being, you're probably going to have a hard time anytime you have to step out and deal with the world. So the idea is to discover that the world is really an emanation of the inner. The inner is emerging from, or the outer is emerging from the inner, manifesting itself in this most extraordinary reality, and then returning. And it does it like breath. Inhalation, exhalation, and it keeps happening. And we are the both, we are both. We are, or let's say we're it all, we're everything, which is remarkable. Except that there's another polarity in all of this, that there is everything and nothing. There is hundreds of billions and trillions and zillions of stuff, and there is zero. We are zero, and we are all the things that are. How is that possible? No way to know. No way to understand it. Trying to understand it will be a waste of time, but witnessing it is not a waste of time. Witnessing the ineffable truth of being, that you are everything and nothing simultaneously, brings you into a state of absolute awe, awareness, presence, knowing and not knowing, being. It brings you into life itself, life itself. Mundane, simple life is not other than that. The everything of being is not different than the nothing from which it emerges. It's all one constant living being. So that birth and arrival in the world and manifestation and creation and building and structuring and having and acquiring and enjoying the world is part of something that will then go into losing every ounce of it. And as you lose it, you will perhaps begin to realize the treasure that you just had. And if you can avoid grief and just sit back and understand or realize or witness this is how it works, you will discover that the exquisite nature of everything is in every second of your being and in your doing. They are all the same thing. And if you are really awake to that, if you are enlightened from the burden of being unhappy in all of it or reactive to it, if you just open to and accept all of it, there is this exquisite presence that animates and fills every square inch of it. And if you are not experiencing that, you have something to look forward to. In a sense, the evolutionary impulse is to grow into the witnessing and knowing of that. But as I speak regularly here. There is no moment where it's not happening, and there is nothing to get to have it happen. It's happening as we speak. The only problem is you're not sitting in a space that's aware of the very thing that you are. That's the only problem. And it's not even a problem because the universe doesn't care. It doesn't care whether you're seeing it or not seeing it. You care. Your caring is everything. Your desire, your hunger, your need to become one with what is going on, one with the suffering, one with the beauty, one with the terror, one with the joy, finding yourself able to see what that is and how lucky you are to be part of it. That's the journey. That's what we're all doing. We're all trying to do. Those of you who are just in the world probably will not feel satisfied. Those of you who are just on the inner journey, expanding into your nothingness, will probably feel special, but you're still alive and something's going to grab you. You know, they're still going to rip your body into shreds. And you're going to have to deal with that. And if you haven't figured it out, you know, you're unprepared for that. So find the balance. Find the harmony between the inner and the outer. Recognize, if you can, that this is that. That the world you are in is all there is. It is infinite, timeless being wrapped up in time and space. You are the very thing. You are the manifestation of the very thing you are seeking to discover. You are its expression. You are its fullness or its incompleteness. And its incompleteness is just as meaningful as its fullness. This is what you're looking for. And so as soon as you start to go, well, I don't want that part. I want this. I don't want that. That's where you get in trouble. The minute you go, I'll take the good part and not the bad part. It doesn't work out that way. It's everything or nothing. Everything or nothing. And you have to say yes to everything. You have to find that voice in yourself. And I can only tell you, there is a voice in yourself that knows what I'm saying, that in fact is speaking to you now. You are the thing you're looking for. And it is everything and it is nothing. It's not going to make sense, but you'll know it's true. So take a trip up to the stupa, and or any stupa, or any place in the world that's both in creation and demolition. Anything that's falling apart has beauty. Anything that's being built is beautiful. It's all part of this unbelievable creation that we are. Try to appreciate it. Any questions?
When you first started to speak about the beauty of decay, I just thought of that there was a little synchronicity in my life this week. For some reason, I turned to wabi-sabi. So I, from their appearance, I said, why do you have tango? But of course, then I had to look up what wabi-sabi was, which is the celebration of both the decay and the beauty in Japanese art. You talked about the comfort and the discomfort. And the discomfort gets us to the comfort, but the comfort's never stable. So we go back to the discomfort so that we could grow. And the doing and the nothingness, I find I just do too many things. And I think I do too many things like a lot of people because I'm afraid of the nothingness of what would happen if I didn't do all these things.
Well, I mean, you're going to discover, at least as I have, that there'll come a point where there's less to do. Where you wake up in the morning and the to-do list is very small. You know, eat breakfast, go to the bathroom, look out the window. That's your to-do list. What do you do with that to-do list? It's going to happen if you live long enough and luckily are lucky enough to have that occur. The to-do list is all part of a certain kind of structuring of life, and we all have it. But it really does come to a point where it diminishes. It's not completely gone, You know, because you will start to say, well, what can I do? What can I do now that there is nothing to do? Well, there's a world full of need, and there's all sorts of ways to meet that need that can become instructive, creative, but it won't be like the building of a life you had before. It will be sustaining people in their own struggle and drama of life if you become a helper to people, or a lover, or a giver, or whatever it is you become. Or you can sit still in your apartment and look out the window and just sit in the rocking chair, which is not, you know, it's not the worst thing in the world, but you get choice. You can get choice to do rather than this obligation of, I gotta eat, I gotta make stuff happen. You know, and nowadays people don't have a lot of money, so they do get to a place of nothing to do, but they still gotta maybe, you know, go work at Walmart or whatever it is to keep doing, to keep eating, to keep that stuff going. That is kind of a dilemma that a lot of people face, and actually for billions of years, or millions of years anyway, the human race didn't get to retire. You know, either you work in the fields and grow crops and eat, or you die. You know, so right now we have the possibility in human life of a lot of stillness. We really do, and possibly more as human life becomes replaced by artificial life. It's going to create an entirely new way of looking at the world. What doing is just not going to be quite what it was. Well, then what? Because we have the capacity to sustain the human race without a lot of human doing. So reinventing the human condition is kind of on the horizon, and it's really going to be interesting. It would be great if this spiritual clarity helped to fuel that, but that's not a given. And a lot of people are going to rebel against all of what, you know, this idea of being, because they're afraid to give up doing. I completely understand it, but much of doing is based exactly on what you said, fear of nothing. Fear of nothing. And that fear of nothing will last until you develop the skill or the ability to sit still and look at what nothing is. And when you discover that nothing, no thing, is everything, you go, oh. And when you discover that no thing has certain qualities, at least for a while, of bigness, comfort, joy, clarity, all of these qualities, until it has none of those, until it gets beyond all of that. But by that point, there's no you to care about it. There's no you that goes, oh, I'm uncomfortable. Oh, I'm fearful. There's nobody left to do that. There's just the thing itself. And you are that very thing. And you go into a state of pure being. And then somewhere, for reasons we don't understand, you may decide to come back into doing, into human experience, into becoming a baby again, you know, to being born again. And then you get to ride this out again, figure it out again. Or maybe, as the Buddhists say, you become a bodhisattva, you come back with the knowledge of this, and you come back in the world to do what all of us are here, I think, capable of doing, share this with people. Because most people don't know what we're talking about. And you can find ways into opening them to that possibility. And trust me, as the world goes through the changes it's about to go through, people are going to be really interested. Because how do you exist when you don't need to do anything? I mean, what if really the government provided everybody with a house and food? If we did that. I mean, I don't know the likelihood of it, but we could do that. And we started to give everybody enough, the health care, all the benefits of a social life, without having to go out there and work for it. What do you do? Big question. People who are creative say, oh, that's great. I'll draw, I'll write, I'll make movies, I'll make television shows. I don't know what people will do. But there are a lot of people who don't have that. And they're going to have to also sit down and go, what do I do, without rebelling against the system? And as you go deep into this inner space, the impetus to do will form itself, and it will tell you what to do. You will feel what to do. It won't be outer directed, it will be inner directed, and that could be beautiful, really beautiful. You know, I mean, the potential in human life for a perfect world, a perfect union, really does exist. It's just not easy to get to. And, I mean, I understand the fear of nothingness, and I appreciate you spoke about it, but it is at the source of what keeps a lot of us engaged. And at some point, you can't look away. It's right in front of you.
I find the best part of growing old is having time for meditation. Having time to just go out and sit under the trees and just be thankful.
I mean, I love that you find that. And I wish that were true of people who grow old in general. I don't experience that. I've watched people grow old with a lack of grace, you know, who don't know how to sit still, who are totally programmed still for doing and can't, whose minds start to go, you know, totally off the grid because they don't know how to function anymore. You are not that person, and you represent to me what it should be. What would be wonderful, Dale, if people could find the joy of having nothing to do as an enrichment, not as a diminishment. You know, liberation from self is liberation. You know, being liberated from the world of doing is a freedom that is beyond understanding. But our culture doesn't grasp that. But, you know, you can be the living example of it, and there will be people who will see you, know you, touch your truth, and it will ripple out gently and into the world, and other people will know it. Your children will know it. Your grandchildren will know it. And luckily, you have 5 children. So there's going to be a lot of people who will learn from your being.
I hope so.
It will happen. You know, they'll live it their own way. Jill.
You know, it's interesting. Until you spoke, I didn't think of this. But when you spoke about inner, whatever you have here, it comes out. And I guess it was maybe 6 months ago, it dawned on me, like one day it was the aha, and I just was like, everything I'd asked for, because I have to work, I don't have a lot of money, so I have to work. But everything I asked for, I actually got. I actually had in my heart, I guess, what I needed to sustain what I have and need to survive. And I created a business that I work not a whole lot. I work hard when I work, and now I have other people to help me, so I work less, and I make the same amount for some reason. I don't understand, but that's good too. But it just found it interesting because it is true, and it took me, I guess, 8 years to finally go, wait a minute, wow, you wanted 2 cars, you have 2. You needed this, you have that. And I am off all winter.
Well, let me address this for one brief moment, because it's really interesting. The universe provides. It truly provides. And the more you are surrendered to it, the more it will provide. It is shocking how much it gives. On the other hand, and I say this as a warning to you, to me, and everybody else, I was describing this to a number of us on a walk today. sometimes when I'm driving down the street, every light is green. Mm-hmm. It's just one green light, one green light, one green light after another, and I'm going, oh, I am in flow. Red light. Instantly, not 20 minutes later. Mm-hmm. It's instant response. Mm-hmm. The minute I own it or take pride in it or think that I have done it, it will absolutely crash the system. Mm-hmm. It does it because it needs to. Because it needs to awaken you to the fact that every microsecond is to be experienced with grace and appreciation. And the minute you are prideful of it, pride goeth before a fall. The minute you walk around saying, I have it, over.
No, it's gratitude.
Yes, gratitude is the key. I'm so grateful for every green light, and when the red light comes, I sit down and go,
exactly.
Now I can take a breath.
Like, I actually had a problem, and I kind of was like, someone didn't want to pay me, and I kind of thought about it, and I was angry at her behavior, but then I went, you know what, I just sent her a text with the facts and reality, and I didn't have any energy, I didn't put anything in it, and the next thing you know, she's like, send me your address.
I will tell you, one of the best ways to address the world is openly, lovingly, honestly. Not with your anger and emotion and the stuff that makes you crazy, because that will never serve you. Anything that's invested in that will come back to haunt you. It simple, open, compassionate honesty with everyone brings back everything you need, and it brings it back without karmic consequence. Karmic consequence is when you say something negatively, it brings back a deluge of consequence that you do not want to deal with. And you can actually get to a point in life where you no longer create consequence just by being open-hearted and honest.
The reason I even brought it up was to really just concrete what you said.
No, I'm happy. I'm happy you brought it up.
And it was interesting that I'd never paid attention to it. I just took it on a roll.
Every time I find a bathroom when I need a bathroom, I am in total thank you, Lord. You know, truly. And as you get older, that happens more than you imagine. And you just really are like, oh, thank you, because it didn't have to happen. You know, we used to have to stop the car for my mom so she could go off in the bushes, you know, because she just, there was nowhere to go. And I felt for her. She was shamed by it, and it was difficult, you know. And I've had my own episodes along the way, and I don't want to bring this down into defecation and stuff. But, you know, ultimately, the universe cares mostly enough to provide for us in what we need. It just does. It's constructed to do that. It's constructed to love us and provide. And when it doesn't provide, it may be the end game. When you enter the end game, and we all will, what you want will not come. When you enter the end game, you are no longer given the stuff the ego mind hungers for. It will say, sorry, no more. And at that moment, all of the years and years of practice and effort that you have created comes into play, and you can go, thy will be done. And you leave graciously. And it will happen. Seth?
I have a question about writing, actually. Has somewhat similar aspirations to what you went through. I remember you saying yesterday how you can speak to the masses, but only a few are touched or impacted. How would you go about it differently so you could actually, like, you know, have resonance between the inner and outer and also help and fulfill and all that stuff?
You know, Eckhart Tolle and I had a dialogue maybe 9 months ago or so about, why do we do this? Why do we put this stuff out there? Why do we keep having retreats and talking about this stuff? And we both arrived at the same realization that it wants to be spoken. It's not about how many people need to hear it, or whether you are talking to a vast audience or an audience of one or two. It only, you have to understand that this voice in you, the deeper voice, wants to be spoken. If it's coming from ego mind, nobody cares. You know, you can write something, a horror film that everybody will go see, and it will touch and scare millions of people. You know, that's the world. And that's karma creating, by the way. You scare people, you know, stuff will come back. It really will. If you bring your heart to the screen or to the book, the novel or the painting that I know you do, if you bring yourself to all of that, it simply ripples out. It frees you of that stuff, and it allows you to serve the voice that is evolving within you as we speak. This thing is developing and developing and developing, and it will find its way out. How you can speak ultimate truth, I don't know. I've given up as a filmmaker trying to do it. I couldn't find, every movie that I ever wrote was one sentence of an idea. I couldn't give a talk like this in a movie because nobody would come. Nobody would listen to this. And there aren't that many people even now who listen to it, you know, but it's out there and it's the voice that wants to be spoken. Forget your audience on some level. Find the voice. Find the thing that wants to be out there and let it go. Let it ripple into wherever it will go. People who need it will be there and show up, and the flow of it outward will be so satisfying to you. You will be so grateful that you gave it credence, that you gave it energy, that you allowed it to be born. Just the way my children come to me and tell me, thank you for bringing me into the world. And as I would say to my own parents, you know, middle of World War II, they gave birth to me. Why would anybody do that? Give birth to someone in the middle of the worst conflagration in the world. And yet, I've had a most amazing life. You can give birth to thoughts, ideas, teachings. If they come really from the depth of your soul, they will go out and ripple into the world. And one person may come back and say thank you. Somebody was driving me to the airport in Sedona when I was there. And I got in the car with Blanche and we're being taken to the airport. And he said, I have to tell you something. He said, I saw your movie, Ghost. He said, 30 years ago almost. He said, it changed my life. It created a spiritual life inside me. And I would not be here today if it wasn't for you. And he'd done two paintings that he wanted to give me because he knew he was picking me up to go to the airport. And if I hadn't been in Sedona and he hadn't been the driver, I would never have known that something I had done had impacted him. I would never have known. And I live just happily as can be without knowing. But those little moments where it comes together and you realize you touch somebody is exquisitely satisfying because that's all it wants. It wants to touch people and plant these little tiny grace notes in people's heads that allow them to go, oh, ah, wow. And that's what you are born here. That's what you're born to do. So find it first. You can't teach it until you know it. You can't express it until it's alive and well inside you. And it may take time. It took me until I was in my 40s. I couldn't find a way to it. I kept trying, but I couldn't quite get there. And then maturity occurred, and mature voice was allowed to go forward. I also had an astrological configuration that gave me 17 years of a career, really, of stuff happening that had nothing to do with me on any level. And when that was over, it was over. And I don't miss it for a second. So take your time, find who you are, find what you need to say, and let it arise. I've seen it arise in your paintings. I haven't read your work, but it's there. It wants to be spread out. It wants to be shared. You will do it. Okay? Jordan.
It seems as if there's a kind of relationship between flow and surrender. I mean, maybe they're the same, but I was particularly mindful in sitting today. This old habit of grabbing onto something that you spoke to the other day. I'm just wondering if you could say a few words.
Well, the first thing to know is that flow does not always come out of surrender. Sometimes surrender is to nothing, to no flow, to total obstruction. Okay. I sit down sometimes and there's nothing there. And I go, like, what am I doing wrong? How do I deal with the nothing? You know, especially when you're teaching. You know, I go, it's not there. And then I go, okay. I just sit and I watch the nothing express itself. I watch how it works its way into people. It wouldn't work its way into people if it was flowing because they would have something to react to. But they have nothing to react to when there's nothing. So they're just there and they're just open and it's going, whoop, it's just going in. And I say, okay, that's how it works. It's flow is an experience that makes us feel good, that makes us feel that we're touching it. But you have to feel good not touching it, not being connected. Every element of the human experience, every element from the worst to the best, is all one thing. It's not better or worse than something else. It's like just go, okay. When I sit and I experience pain, you know, I have a lot of nerve compression right now, which is just very painful. I don't try to run away. I go, okay, and it informs the teaching. I don't know how it informs the teaching, but I feel it. It comes up, and it opens, and it spreads around, and the teaching uses it in a way, and it filters through the room, and it touches things in people. I don't know how it works. I have no idea. But I know I see the interaction, I see the connection, I see the unfolding in other people, and I go, my pain brought something, a release to somebody else. If you look, I mean, maybe Einstein could have figured out those laws of, you know, in the world. I don't know them. I'm not an Einstein. I'm not someone who can put it into concrete form. But I watch it happen, and I watch it with amazement. And that's my biggest gift, in a way, is that I can go, wow. And thank you. So be careful wanting flow. Okay? Flow is great, but it's not essential. It'll happen when it wants to happen, and it will get dammed up when it wants to get dammed up, and it may overflow the banks at times. You know, you just don't know. Anyone else? You only get one shot, guys. Okay. Thank you. Lunchtime, 3 o'clock. We'll come back for whatever occurs at 3 o'clock. Could be questions and answers. It may be more than that, but we will definitely have a class and sit one more time. Okay, thank you.